Major Williams reel two.
Received a hell of a licking, really, partly because they could not comprehend the ability of the Japanese living off the land to constantly bypass them on the settled routes of communication, which in Burma run north and south. There's hardly anything that moves east-west. They follow the river routes, the Irrawaddy, the Chindwin, the Shwebo, and I think possibly, and that history is now recorded, that we were not, as an army, properly trained for fighting in that kind of terrain. So, going back to our job in central India, I think that it was believed there would be ultimately an invasion of India by the Japanese over the Assam frontier, Assam border. And so our training was directed to counterattacking the kind of Japanese invasion that could at that time be expected. This training was quite hard. It went on during the monsoon, of which we'd not previously had any experience. We were living well away from any settled habitation. We were in a very deep and densely forested area. The only problem that we had was that I think the forces in India had at that time, they didn't really know how secure the civil obedience or civil disobedience campaign that was being mounted by the Indian Congress Party would be. And in the midst of this training, we were suddenly called out to protect the railways against Congress-inflamed insurrection. I suppose insurrection is the right word to use, because India, there was what was, we were the paramount power in India, but there was beginning to emerge a very strong pro-Japanese element among Indian politicians, who I think probably thought that we'd had it as the power, and they would have to make their future with the Japanese. Anyway, my particular role in this was to, I had two platoons under command, and we were responsible for about 80 miles of railway line in the Patna area. We were there for several weeks, and then ultimately the disturbances died down, and we resumed our role as the counterattacking force against a supposed Japanese invasion.
Was there any attack on that 80 miles of line which you were responsible for?
There were attempts to derail engines, but they were pretty amateurish. We had plate layers from the Indian Railways themselves, and they were able to repair railway lines where the chairs had been taken away, which would have parted if a train had gone over. So we were patrolling the line all the time in these lightweight, hand-driven buggies, you know, the sort of thing you probably see in films. But there was nothing really of any significance happening in my particular area.
Where what had been taken away, did you say?
The chairs. You know, railway lines are secured to sleepers by chairs, and these can be unbolted from
those
the sleepers.
Those metal things that join the sleeper to the rail?
That's it, yes. Yeah. They can
called
be
unbolted.
and they can be unbolted from the sleepers, and of course a train passing over would separate the rail.
Do you remember the names of any villages?
Well, I was actually, my headquarters was in a, it was more than a village, it was a town of nearly 100,000 inhabitants. But it was not really a town of the nature that you would recognize. It was just a long series of villages, really, but just known as Lucky Serai. Lucksrai, Lucky Serai. We arrived there actually with only just a very light pack, with no equipment, no spare clothing or anything like that. We were called out at a moment's notice, and as time went on, we were obviously running short of changes of clothing and all the rest of it, and I suppose one could call him the mayor, but anyway, he was the chief civilian in this village. Incidentally, I did have an Indian magistrate with me the whole time, because we were there in support of the civil power. It was not, we were not controlling the situation directly. We could only react on the instructions of a magistrate.
Do you remember who he was?
He was an Indian. I can't remember his name. He was quite a jolly chap, really.
Did he come from that area?
No, he didn't. No, he came from Calcutta, I think. Certainly he came from the east of India. He spoke immaculate English, a little bit in a sing-song way, as you know. Peter Sellers would imitate, but he was easy to get on with, and he was very fair in his judgments. We had on one occasion to open fire on a crowd that was approaching the station in many thousands, and his instructions were followed to the letter, and that was, he through a loud hailer ordered the crowd to depart when I took over, and then he ordered me to fire, and my job was to make sure that only one person was shot and was to be handicapped rather than killed. So we selected a man who appeared to be the ringleader, and a marksman in the platoon was ordered to shoot him in the legs, which he did do. And on that, the whole crowd disappeared, dispersed. So nobody was killed. A thing that one ought to remember is that, and I didn't know this until I was involved with it, you never fire over the heads of a crowd, because you may, in fact, be killing somebody who was not involved with it at all. If you fire, you must fire deliberately to a particular target and not indiscriminately.
So was this chap captured?
No, no, he was taken away. We never saw him.
Taken away by the crowd?
Yeah, yeah. This business of...
Was that Lucky Serai?
That was Lucky Serai. Well, it was outside Lucky Serai. It was about, I suppose, about 6 or 7 miles from Lucky Serai. But the chief citizen of Lucky Serai was, again, he was an English-speaking gentleman, and he wanted to know in what way could he help, which was rather nice to know. And I said, well, we lacked new shirts and fresh clothing. And so literally within 24 hours, I had about 60 men there. Everybody had 2 new shirts and shorts and so on, as we paid for them, incidentally, but they were organized, this change of clothing was organized by the town itself.
What was the demeanor of this crowd?
Threatening. But I think threatening in a threatening merely because of their numbers, you know, threatening in a passive sort of way, they were clearly being encouraged to come forward and destroy telephone lines and so on. But they didn't show a lot of enthusiasm to do that. But it was a situation that could have got out of hand. I mean, we're talking of several thousand. We're not talking about a few hundred. We're talking about several thousand.
What was the manner of your men? How did they react to doing it?
In a very phlegmatic way, you know. totally unexcited about the whole thing. The British soldier in India, through long, I suppose, long experience, believed that he was capable of dealing with anything that happened. Well, that was it. The thing that impressed me was the calm decision of the magistrate to say, do that. That's what I would want you to do. We did nothing without the magistrate instructing us to do it. And the only thing that I had, a rules of engagement kind of book, not book, but a pamphlet, telling me what I shouldn't do. Never fire over the heads of a crowd. Never fire indiscriminately. One shot is usually enough, and so on. You know, and pick out a ringleader, deal with that. So it was not a massacre situation or anything like that.
Did you feel nervous yourself?
Yes, I did. I felt concerned a bit. I suppose. Well, it's quite a responsibility. I was about 22 at that time, and these are all new experiences that, I was 23. But it just goes to show that you, no matter how calm people nowadays in Northern Ireland or in the Gulf may appear on the surface, the person who has the ultimate responsibility has got a maelstrom of worry and concern that he can't reveal, really.
Was the magistrate older than you?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was middle-aged, probably in his 40s, 50s, something like that.
And so you were under his orders, really?
Oh, yes, yes. We were there in support of the civil power. The martial law had not been declared, which would have been an entirely different matter, because in those circumstances, the army then takes over. And we were still in support of the civil power.
Were there any police around?
No.
Police?
There were police, but they were not present. I never saw a policeman there. There must have been police there. Must have been police, but I didn't see any.
Were there any arms of any nature in the crowd, or stones?
Stones, yes. Stones, certainly. But no firearms that I recall.
Were they throwing stones?
Oh, yes, they were throwing stones. But this is a very singular incident. It may not be typical of others that happened, because certainly in other areas, arms were used. But not in this particular incident.
Did any of the stones hit your unit?
No.
Were you a captain or a lieutenant?
I was a lieutenant then, yes.
Could you tell from the crowd whether they were Hindus or Muslims?
Oh, they were Hindus. Only because that was, as you know, India. Certain parts of India were predominantly Hindu and some were predominantly Muslim. But the Congress Party was Hindu, was Hindi. They were carrying the flags of the Communist Party. So they were.
The Communist or Congress?
Sorry, did I say Communist? Congress Party.
Did you have any other incidents during the Quit India movement that you can recount?
Not really, no. I mean, occasionally, for example, well, I went on leave to Calcutta, and I went on leave on one occasion to Bhopal, which was a prince state, not in British India, because there were some states that were still ruled by the ruling princes. And I met with nothing other than courtesy and, you know, no problems at all.
Did you feel at all uneasy as you went about in India in view of the civil disobedience situation?
No. We were advised never to walk about singly in a town, but I don't recall any particular incident that I was that worried me.
Did people obey that, about walking about not singly?
Oh yes, I think so. Yes. So far as I, this is all many years ago, but I think that the, in my experience, the regiments that I knew of behaved with restraint, with firmness when it was necessary, but they certainly weren't out of hand, and there certainly wasn't the kind of wholesale insurrection, if that's the right word for it, I suppose, that perhaps was assumed. Nothing like the scale that one sees on the television screens today. Nothing like that at all.
From where do you have in mind?
Well, I was thinking more particularly of the problems in some of the African, East African countries, where you've got enormous desolation being caused by almost a civil war going on between different factions.
Like Somalia. What do you think was the general attitude of the population at large towards the British presence and towards you as British troops going about?
I can't really say with much authority, because being in the army and an army at war, one tended to be in almost an encapsulated position. I certainly didn't mix with Indians in the way in which one might have done if one was a resident there over a number of years. All I know was that this civil disobedience did for a time tie down, or appear to tie down, quite a large number of troops, but it amounted to very little in the end, and certainly didn't interfere with the actions of my particular division. And have in mind as well that there were quite a number. The Indian Army is largely of Indian troops, officered by British soldiers, and there were one or two incidents of particularly, I think, one battalion of Sikhs that mutinied, but I wasn't aware of anything else.
But you didn't have any first-hand knowledge of that mutiny?
No.
But as you went about, would you ever get any hostility from Indian civilians?
No. Not hostility, no.
Would people ever say, why don't you British go home?
There would be chalked or painted signs like Quit India and things like that. But apart from that, no more than I suppose one saw Go Home Yanks in this country.
Did you ever get to know any Indians personally? Were you invited to homes?
On two occasions. The first one goes back to the first time I went to India. This is backtracking a bit. A lot of Italian officers, Italian soldiers, were sent to India as prisoners of war. And I was OC troops on a Dutch ship called the Slammet, and we took 800 Italian officers, all of field rank or higher, to Bombay. And I was in Bombay before I returned to Egypt for a few weeks. And during that time, I received quite a lot of hospitality. And in particular, from two of the princes of Bhopal, who I met in rather unusual circumstances. The household control of their mother was an English lady called Miss Stella Murray, and she had very close friends who were... he was the manager of the Bombay Electrical Supply and Transport. But he came from Wolverhampton, that's the point I'm coming to. And as a consequence of this sort of introduction, I ultimately met the princes of Bhopal, who had a flat in on Malabar Hill in Bombay. And following that, we had hospitality from them. And then later, when we returned to India, dealing with the Japanese situation, I had an invitation to spend a leave in Bhopal with the Begum Saba of Bhopal, who was the widow of the previous Nawab of Bhopal. And two of us were on leave there. I had a fabulous time for a fortnight.
Now, can we get back to how you came to be in the Chindits?
That's the main thing, isn't it? Yes. Well, I suppose we're talking now 1944. Or 43 it starts, really. During the summer of 43, the battalion was involved with an action in the Arakan. Suddenly rushed, the whole brigade was rushed to the Arakan because there was a Japanese penetration coming up the coast from Bawley Bazaar and Cox's Bazaar, and along the east line of the Bay of Bengal. We arrived there and saw nothing. I learnt afterwards that the Japanese advance had not continued, so we didn't see anything at all. We returned to India and were concentrating in Bangalore. It seems in the state of Mysore. We're right in the south of India, and for the life of me, I can't understand why we suddenly ended up there, but that's where we got to. And there was a tremendous rumor going through the regiment that, in fact, we were going back to the United Kingdom to form part of the Second Front. As time went on, we did a lot of training. And at that time, I was motor transport officer. And we had a lecture. The officers were given a lecture by one of the officers returning from the first Chindit expedition, which was of brigade strength. And we listened in awe to this chap and what they had done, and so and thought, well, thank God we're not involved with that kind of situation. Imagine that when a short time after that, the whole brigade was addressed by the brigade commander, and we were told that we had been selected to form part of the second Chindit expedition. And the South Staffords were then joined a new brigade, the 77th Brigade, commanded by Brigadier Michael Calvert, who had been on the first expedition. And in that brigade, we had three other battalions, the Lancashire Fusiliers, the Kings, 3rd, 6th Gurkhas, and ourselves. And we went from Bangalore, we went back to central provinces to train and to become an animal transported. No, I've rephrased that. Our transport was now going to be animals. And because of my experience in the Staffordshire Yeomanry, I suppose, I always thought it was because of that, but I learnt afterwards because I was the MTO, so I became the ATO, the Animal Transport Officer. But I think it was because it was known that I'd had some experience handling horses. And I took delivery of about 100 mules and 30 horses. And there's a question of training mule leaders and riders and all the ancillary trades that one would need to have, like saddlers, veterinary staff. We didn't have any farriers. We didn't need them because mules marching over rough country don't need shoes. But all the various things that I recall from the Staffordshire Yeomanry were now transmitted into looking after mules took place, like grooming and the general care and attention to animals. The training of mule leaders is interesting because there were no people in the battalion who'd had any experience with mules. And so in the first place, volunteers were called for. And volunteers were sadly lacking. Nobody particularly wanted to be a mule leader. So in the end, rifle companies sent me men, and you can well imagine that they probably sent me the people that they wished to get rid of. But they turned out to be the most magnificent mule leaders and formed a very close, almost partnership with the animals that they were leading. We had four classes of mule, mountain artillery. These were quite big animals, about 1,200 pounds in weight. E1, who were around about 1,000 pounds. E2, around about 700 or 800 pounds in weight. Giving these weights because of the importance that were attached to weights later on. And then the smallest mules would be around about 600 pounds. And the loads they carried ranged from wireless sets and generating sets for power, machine guns and ammunition. Ammunition generally for Bren guns. And